loved to look at, not because another found her lovely, but because her unique characteristics spoke to me. He brushed the corner of her mouth with his fingers. Mayhap she would have a dimple on one side of her mouth when she smiled. Mayhap she would have a witch mark. He slid his hand up to the small mole on her right cheekbone, high up on one cheek. Mayhap she would have stormy eyes that remind me of the sea I so love. But there are other characteristics far more important than her appearance. My woman would be one curious about the world and like to learn. She would want children and love them no matter what. She would have a fearless heart, courage, and compassion. He spoke from the heart, his voice deepening with passion. He freed what was bottled up inside him and told her exactly what he wanted. She would be one who would talk with me into the wee hours about anything and everything, who would savor all the tempers of the Highlands, who would treasure family, a woman who could find beauty in the world, in me, and in the world we could make together. She would be my honored companion, adored lover, and cherished wife. Gwyn drew a deep breath. The skeptical look in her eyes faded. She shifted uncomfortably, glanced away from him, and was silent for a time. He didn't interrupt, curious to see how she would respond to his honest declaration. He smiled wryly when she cleared her throat, and glibly changed the subject.
Well, if you're from the 16th century Highlands, why don't you speak Gaelic?
Give nothing away, lass, he thought. Who or what hurt you that makes you so conceal your feelings? Gaelic! You wish Gaelic! With a wolfish smile, he told her exactly what he wanted to do to her once he removed her clothing, first in Gaelic, then in Latin, and finally in a language that had not been spoken in centuries, not even in his time. It made him hard saying the words.
That could be gibberish, she snapped.
But she shivered, as if she'd sensed the intent behind his words. Then why did you test me? He asked quietly.
I need something to prove it, she said. I can't just go on blind faith.
Nay, he agreed. You dinna seem to be a woman who could.
Well, you had proof, she countered, then added hastily. Of course, pretending that what you claim is true. You saw cars, the village, my phone, my clothing.
He gestured at his attire, his sword, and shrugged.
That could be a costume.
What would you consider sufficient proof? She folded her arms across her chest.
I don't know, she admitted.
I can prove it to you at the stones, he finally said. Beyond any doubt, I can prove it to you there.
How?
He shook his head. You must come and see.
You think your ancestors might have some record of you? A portrait or something? She guessed.
Gwyn, you must decide whether I am mad or I am telling the truth. I cannot prove it to you until we reach our destination. Once we reach Bandracaid, if you still do not believe me, there at the stones when I have done what I can to offer you proof, I will ask nothing more of you. What have you to lose, Gwyn Cassidy? Is your life so demanding and full that you cannot spare a man in need a few days of your time? He'd won. He could see it in her eyes. She looked at him in silence for a long time. He met her gaze steadily, waiting. Finally, she gave a tight nod.
I will make sure you get to your stone safely, but that doesn't mean for a minute that I believe you. I'm curious to see what proof you can offer me that your incredible story is true. Because if it is...
She trailed off and shook her head.
Suffice it to say, such proof would be worth hiking across the Highlands to see. But the moment you show me whatever it is you have to show me, if I still don't believe you, I'm done with you, okay?
Okay, he repeated. The word meant nothing to him in any language.
Do you agree to our deal?
She clarified.
A deal you agree to honor fully, she stressed.
Aye. The moment I show you the proof, if you still do not believe, you'll be free of me. but you must promise to stay with me until you actually see the proof." Deep inside, Druston winced, loathing the carefully phrased equivocation.
"I accept, but you will not chain me, and I must eat. And right now I'm going for a short walk in the woods, and if you follow me, it will make me very, very unhappy."
She hopped down from the fallen tree trunk and skirted around him, giving him a wide berth. "As you wish, Gwyn Cassidy." She stooped and reached for her pack, but he moved swiftly and wrapped his hand around her wrist. "Nay, if you go, it stays with me."
"I need a few things," she hissed.
"You may take one item with you," he said, reluctant to interfere if she had womanly needs. Mayhap it was her time of the moon. Angrily, she dug in the pack and withdrew two items, a bar of something and a bag. Defiantly, she stuffed the bar in the bag and said,
"See, it's only one thing now."
She turned abruptly and headed for the woods. "I'm sorry, lass," he whispered when he was certain she was out of hearing range. He had no choice but to make her his unwitting victim. Larger issues than his own life depended upon it. Gwen hurriedly used the facilities, anxiously scanning the forest around her, but it didn't appear that he had followed her. Still, she didn't trust a thing about her current situation. After relieving herself, she devoured the protein bar she'd grabbed. She rummaged through her cosmetics bag, flossed, then dabbed a touch of toothpaste to her tongue. The taste of mint boosted her flagging spirits. A swipe of a medicated pad over her nose, cheeks, and forehead nearly made her swoon with pleasure. Sweaty and exhausted, she felt more alive than ever. She was beginning to fear for her own sanity because there was a part of her that wanted to believe him, wanted desperately to experience something outside her everything-can-be-explained-by-science existence. She wanted to believe in magic, in men who made her feel hot and weak-kneed, and in crazy things like spells. Nature or nurture? Which was the determining factor? She'd been obsessing over that question lately. She knew what nurture had done to her. At 25, she had a serious intimacy problem, aching for a thing she couldn't name and terrified of it at the same time. But what was her nature? Was she truly brilliant and cold like her parents? She recalled all too well the time she'd been foolish enough to ask her father what love was. "Love is an illusion clung to by the fiscally challenged, Gwyn. It makes them feel life might be worth living. Choose your mate by IQ, ambition, and resources. Better yet, let us choose him for you. Already I have several suitable matches in mind." Before she'd indulged in her great fit of rebellion, she dutifully dated a few of her father's choices. Dry, intellectual men, they'd regarded her more often than not through eyes red-rimmed from constant peering into a microscope or textbook, with little interest in her as a person, and great interest in what her formidable parents might do for their careers. There'd been no passionate declarations of undying love, only fervent assurances that they would make a brilliant team. Gwendolyn Cassidy, the sheltered daughter of famous scientists who had elevated themselves from stark poverty as children to esteemed positions at Los Alamos National Laboratory doing top-secret quantum research for the Department of Defense, had had a nearly impossible time getting a date outside of the cliquish scientific community in which she'd been raised. At college, it had been even worse. Men had dated her for three reasons: to try to get in good with her parents, to see if she had any theories worth stealing, and last but not least, for the prestige of dating the prodigy. Those few who'd been attracted by her other endowments, translated generous C-cups, hadn't lingered long after learning who she was and what courses she was acing while they were hardly managing to skate by. She'd been frighteningly cynical by 21. She dropped out of the doctorate program at 23, carving an irrevocable schism between herself and her parents. Lonely as hell by 25, a veritable island. 2 years ago, she'd thought changing jobs, taking a nice, normal, average job with nice, normal, average people who weren't scientists, would fix her problems. She'd tried so hard to fit in and build a new life for herself, but she'd finally realized it wasn't her career choice that was the problem.
Although she'd told herself that she'd come to Scotland to shuck her virginity, the small deception was how she concealed her deeper and much more fragile motives. The problem was, Gwyn Cassidy didn't know if she had a heart. When Druston had spoken so passionately of what he was looking for in a woman, she'd nearly flung herself at him, madman or no. Family, talking, taking quiet pleasure in the simple, lush beauty of the Highlands, having children who would be loved, fidelity, bonding, and a man who wouldn't kiss another woman if he were wed. She sensed that Druston was a bit of an island himself. Oh, she knew why she'd really come to Scotland. She needed to know if love really was an illusion. She was desperate to change, to find something to shake her up and make her feel. Well, this certainly qualified. If she wanted to become a new person, what better way to start than to force herself to completely suspend disbelief, throw caution to the wind, to toss aside all that she'd been raised to believe and plunge into life, messy as it was, to rescind control over what was happening around her and entrust that control to a madman. Raised in an environment where intellect was prized above all else, here was her chance to act impulsively, on gut instinct, with a gorgeous madman at that. It would be good for her. Who knew what might come of it? She could feel a perfectly vicious cigarette craving coming on.
Come, he said when she returned. He built a fire in her absence, and she considered asking for her lighter back, but was too exhausted to summon up the energy for a potential ownership dispute. Violating her privacy utterly, he'd rummaged through her pack and created a paltry bed by strewing her previously clean clothing upon the ground. A recent acquisition, a vibrantly crimson thong adorned with black velvet silhouettes of romping kittens, poked out from between a sweatshirt and a pair of jeans. She spent a moment calculating the odds that he would pull out the only thong she'd bought but never worn, the thong she planned to wear when she lost her virginity. Inconceivable. She glared suspiciously at him, certain he'd displayed her panties on purpose, but if so, he was the picture of innocence.
"I cannot procure food for you this night," he apologized. "But we will eat in the morning. For now, you must sleep."
She said nothing, merely cast an irritable glance at her clothes, strewn across twigs, leaves, and dirt. Further irritating her, he was standing at the perimeter of the light cast by the flames, making it difficult to see him clearly. But she didn't miss that lazily sensual lion-like toss of his head that sent his silky dark hair falling over his shoulder. It screamed, "Come hither," and pissed her off even more. He met her glare with a provocative smile and gestured toward her clothing.
"I made you a pallet upon which to sleep. In my time, I would spread my plaid for you, but I would also warm you with the heat of my naked body."
"Shall I remove my plaid?"
"No need to bother," she sputtered hastily. "My clothes are fine, wonderful, really."
Despite the abysmal lowlands of her emotions and feverish highlands of her hormones, she was bone-weary and desperate for the plateau of sleep. She'd gotten more exercise today than she got in a month at home. The small pile of her clothing near the fire suddenly seemed as inviting as a down bed.
"What about you?"
she asked, reluctant to sleep if he was going to be awake.
"Although you do not believe me, I slept for a very long time, and find I am most reluctant to close my eyes again. I shall stand watch."
She regarded him warily, and didn't move.
"I would be pleased to give you something to help you relax," he offered.
Her brows furrowed.
"Like what? A drug or something?"
she asked indignantly.
"I have been told I have a calming effect with my hands. I would rub your back, caress your hair until you drifted peacefully."
"I don't think so,"
she said icily. A quick white flash of teeth was the only indication she had that he was amused.
"Then I bid you lie down before you fall down. We must cover a great deal of ground tomorrow. Although I could carry you, I sense you would not appreciate it."
"Damn right, McKelter," she muttered as she relented and dropped to the ground near the fire. She bundled her button-down into a pillow of sorts and stuffed it under her head.
"Are you warm enough?"
he asked softly out of the darkness.
"I am downright toasty,"
she lied. And in truth, she shivered for only a short time before inching closer to the fire and falling into deep and dreamless oblivion. Drustin watched Gwen Cassidy sleep. Her blonde hair, streaked with darker and lighter highlights, shimmered in the firelight. Her skin was smooth, her lips lush and pink, the lower one quite a bit fuller than the top. Kissably full. Above almond-shaped eyes, her dark blonde brows arched upward at the outer edges, adding an aristocratic disdain to the scowl she so frequently wore. She was lying on her side, and her plump breasts pressed together in dangerously tempting curves. But it wasn't her physical attributes alone that stirred him. She was the most unusual woman he'd ever encountered. Whatever had shaped her temperament, she was a curious blend of cautiousness and audacity, and he'd begun to realize she had a clever and quick mind. So wee, she was unafraid to thrust her chin in the air and shout at him. He suspected that audacity was more her nature, while her cautiousness was a learned thing. Her audacity would serve her well in the trials to come, and there would be many. He poked at his memory fragments, which were still frighteningly incomplete. He had 2 days to reclaim perfect recall. It was imperative that he isolate and study every detail of what had happened prior to his enchantment. With a heavy sigh, he turned his back to the fire and stared out into the night at a world he didn't understand and had no desire to be a part of. He found her century unsettling, felt bombarded by the unnatural rhythm of her world, and was comforted by the knowledge that he wouldn't have to spend too much longer in it. As he listened to the unfamiliar sounds of the night, a humming in the air few would hear, a strange intermittent thunder in the sky, he reflected upon his training, sifting through neatly compartmentalized vaults of information stored in his mind. Precision was imperative, and he subdued a surge of unease. He'd never done what he would soon have to do, and although his upbringing had prepared him for it, the possibility for error was immense. His memory was formidable, yet the purpose for which he'd been trained had never taken into account the possibility that he would not be at Castle Keltar when he performed the rite, and thus would not have access to the tablets or any of the books. Although it was widely believed that Druidry had waned, leaving only inept practitioners of lesser spells, and that the ancient scholars had forbidden writing of any kind, both beliefs were myths that had been cultivated and spread by the few remaining druids themselves. It was what they wished the world to believe, and druids were ever adept at illusion. On the contrary, druidry thrived, although the prone-to-melodrama British druids scarce possessed the knowledge to cast an effective sleep spell, in Drustin's estimation. Many millennia ago, after the Tuatha De Danann had left the mortal world for stranger haunts, their druids, mortals and unable to accompany them, had vied among themselves for power. There had ensued a protracted battle that had nearly destroyed the world. In the horrifying aftermath, one bloodline had been selected to preserve the most sacred of the druid lore, and so the Keltar's purpose had been mapped out. Heal. Teach. Guard. Enrich the world for the wrong they'd done it. The fabulous and dangerous knowledge, including sacred geometry and star guides, had been carefully inked in 13 volumes and upon 7 stone tablets, and the Keltar druids guarded that bank of knowledge with their souls. They tended Scotland. They used the stones only when necessary for the world's greater good, and they did their best to quell the rumors about them. The ritual he would perform at Bandrocade required certain formulas that must be without error, and he was uncertain of 3 of them, the critical 3. But who would ever have believed he would be trapped in a future century? If they arrived at the stones and Castle Keltar was gone and the tablets were missing, well, that was why he needed Gwen Cassidy. Bandrocade. His beloved stones were the White Bridge, the bridge of the 4th dimension, time. Millennia ago, druids had observed that man could move in 3 ways, forward and back, side to side, up and down. Then, they discovered the White Bridge, whereupon they could move in a fourth direction. 4 times a year the bridge could be opened, the 2 equinoxes and the 2 solstices. No simple man could avail himself of the White Bridge, but no Keltar had ever been simple. From the beginning of time they had been bred like animals to be anything but. Such power, the ability to travel through time, was an immense responsibility. Thus they adhered unfailingly to their many oaths. She thought him mad now. She would surely abandon him if he overburdened her mind with more of his plans. He couldn't risk telling her anything else. His druid ways had made too many women flee him already. For what time they had left together in her century, he'd like to continue seeing that glimmer of desire in her gaze, not revulsion. He'd like to feel like a simple man with a lovely woman who wanted him. Because the moment he finished the ritual, she would fear him, and mayhap, nay, assuredly, hate him. But he had no other choice. Only the ritual and a fool's hopes. His oaths demanded he return to avert the destruction of his clan. His oaths demanded he do whatever was necessary to accomplish that. He closed his eyes, hating his choices. If Gwen had awakened during the night, she would have seen him, head tossed back, gazing up at the sky, speaking softly to himself in a language dead for thousands of years. But once he'd spoken the words of the spell to enhance sleep, she slept peacefully until morning. September 20th, 10:02 a.m. Chapter 6. Gwyn had never felt so acutely 5'2" and 3/4 inches in her life as she did trailing behind the behemoth who didn't understand the concept of physical limitations. As she stretched her legs, swinging her arms to generate greater forward momentum, fully aware of how futile the effort was because momentum was contingent upon mass, and his mass was 3 times hers, ergo, he could outwalk her to infinity barring any unforeseen complications, her temper snapped.
"McKeltar, I'm going to kill you if you don't slow down."
"I am curious to know how you plan to do so when you can't even base me," he teased.
She was not in the mood for teasing.
"I'm tired and I'm hungry."
"You ate one of those bars from your pack a scarce 1/4 hour past when we stopped to examine your map and plot the fastest course," he reminded.
"I'm hungry for real food. And I'm going to need it,"
she thought with a sinking feeling, for the tourist map in her pack had indicated the fastest course from their current location to Bandrocade was 80 miles, cross-country.
"Shall I snare and spit a rabbit for you?"
"A bunny? Was he serious? Ew."
"No. You should stop at the next village. I can't believe you didn't let me go into Fairhaven. We were right there. There was coffee there,"
she added plaintively.
"To reach Bandrocade by tomorrow, we must travel without pause."
"Will you keep stopping to pick up those stupid stones?"
she grumbled.
"You will understand the purpose of my stupid stones tomorrow,"
he said, patting his sporran where he'd stored them.
"Tomorrow. You'll show me tomorrow. Everything will be explained tomorrow. I don't live for tomorrow, and you require a lot of faith, McKelter,"
she said, exasperated. He glanced over his shoulder at her.
I do, Gwen Cassidy, but I give much in return to those people who have faith in me. I could carry you if you wish."
"I don't think so. Why don't you just slow down a bit?"
He stopped, evidencing the first hint of impatience she'd glimpsed.
"Lass, if that map you have is correct, we have until the morrow's eve to travel a distance of nearly 80 miles. That is 3 of your miles per hour, without stopping to sleep, although I could run much of the way, I know you cannot. If you can manage 4 miles each hour, you may rest later."
"That's impossible," Gwyn gasped. "The fastest mile I've ever run on a treadmill was 10.5 minutes, and I nearly died, and it was only 1 mile. I had to rest for hours and eat chocolate to revive myself. McKelter, we need to rent a car,"
she tried again. Earlier, upon discovering the length of the hike he planned, she proposed the alternative, but he'd simply clammed up and dragged her off at a brisk pace.
"We could travel 80 miles in 1 hour in a car."
He glanced at her and shuddered.
I trust my feet. No wagons.
Come on! She nearly wailed. I can't keep up with you. It would be a simple matter. We can go down into the next village, rent a car, drive to your stones, and you can show me whatever it is this afternoon.
I cannot show you until tomorrow. It would be without merit to arrive today.
You said you needed to stop at the castle. If we walk the whole way, that's not going to give you any time to visit your old stomping ground. She pointed out.
I do not stomp there. Nor do I stomp much of anywhere, woman. You drive me to stomp.
A muscle in his jaw jumped.
You must walk more quickly.
You're lucky I'm moving at all. Haven't you heard of Newton's first law of motion? It's inertia, McKelter. An object that's at rest wants to stay at rest. I can't be expected to overcome laws of nature. That's why exercising is so difficult for me. Besides, I think you're afraid.
Gwyn felt a little guilty for playing fast and loose with Newton, but most people had no idea what she was talking about when she brought up the laws of motion, and rather than reveal their ignorance and argue with her, they usually dropped the subject. Dirty pool, but startlingly effective. She'd avail herself of anything that would get her out of walking 80 freaking miles. He was staring at her strangely, with a mixture of startlement and confusion.
I know naught of this Newton, but 'tis clear he failed to attain a complete understanding of objects in motion, and I am hardly afraid of one of your foolish wagons.
He'd never heard of Isaac Newton? Where had the man been living? In a cave? Wonderful, she pounced. If you're not afraid, then let's return to Fairhaven and I'll rent a car. I'll even pay for it myself. We'll be at your castle by lunchtime.
He swallowed hard. He really did have an aversion to cars, she realized. Exactly the kind of aversion a man from 500 years in the past might evidence. Or, she thought cynically, the type of aversion displayed by an actor who had given his performance much thought, down to the minute details. A small, wicked part of her longed to wedge the oversized package of testosterone into a little bitty compact car and see just how far he would carry the performance.
Let me help you, McKelter, she coaxed. You asked for my help. All I'm trying to do is get you to the castle faster than you could possibly get there yourself. Besides, there's no way I'm going to be able to walk for 2 days straight. Either we get a car, or you can just forget about me.
He blew out a frustrated breath.
Fine. I will travel in one of your wagons. You are right in thinking that I need time to prepare, and 'tis plain to see that you do not intend to exert any effort to increase your pace.
Gwyn smiled all the way back to Fairhaven. She would get band-aids for the blisters on her heels where her hiking boots had chafed. She would get coffee and chocolate and scones for breakfast. She would buy him clothes, rent a car, and return him to his family, who would figure out what was wrong with him. It was shaping up to be an acceptable day after all, she thought, sneaking a glance at the luscious man who was walking much slower now. In fact, dragging his feet beside her. He looked miserable. She didn't laugh, because she knew she must have worn an identical expression when they'd been traveling in the opposite direction. The morning was steadily improving. The patch she'd put on earlier while she'd freshened up in the woods was working nicely. Nicotine hummed through her veins, and she was no longer quite so worried that she might, in a fit of irritability, hurt the next person she saw, or worse, suffering oral withdrawal, do something with, or to, some part of Drustan McKelter she would regret. She was going to survive, and she was again in control.
Control is everything.
Her mother, Elizabeth, had often said in that dry, chilly, British voice of hers.
If you control the cause, you own the effect. If you don't, events will unfold like dominoes toppling, and you will have no one to blame but yourself. Oh, do hush up, Mother,
Gwyn thought mulishly. Her parents were dead and still running her life. Still, Elizabeth had been making a valid point. It was only because Gwyn had been distracted by the state of her emotions, a thing Elizabeth had never permitted, that she'd carelessly plunked her backpack down without first examining her surroundings. Had she been paying attention, she would not have placed the pack in such a precarious position. But she had, and it had fallen out of reach, and she'd ended up in a cave. That single moment of carelessness had gotten her stuck in the highlands with a very ill or very deranged man.
It was too late for regret. She could only exercise damage control. Now she was the one stretching her legs, urging him to walk faster. He did so in brooding silence, so she used the quiet time to firm her resolve that he was not a potential cherry-picker. They made it back to Fairhaven in under an hour, and she sighed with relief at the sight of cozy inns, bike and car rentals, coffee shops and stores. She was no longer alone with him, confronted by the constant temptation to part with her virginity or start smoking again, or both. They would zip into the stores and collect... Oh. She stopped and eyed him with dismay.
You can't come any further, McKelter. There's no way you can walk into the village looking like that.
Sinfully gorgeous, the half-clad warrior could not mingle with tourists looking like a medieval terrorist. He glanced down at himself, then at her.
More of me is covered than you,
he said with an indignant and utterly regal sniff. Figured the man would even sniff like royalty.
Maybe, but you're covered all wrong. Not only are you a walking weapon factory, you have nothing but a blanket wrapped around you.
When he scowled, she hastened to assure him.
It's a very nice blanket, but that's not the point.
You will not leave me, Gwyn Cassidy, he said quietly. I will not have it.
I gave you my word that I would help you get to your stones, she reminded.
I have no way of gauging the sincerity of your word.
My word is good. Besides, you have no other choice.
But I do. We walk.
He took her hand and started to drag her back the way they'd come. Gwyn panicked. There was no way she was walking for 2 days. No way in hell.
All right! She cried. You can come, but you've got to get rid of those weapons. You can't saunter into Fairhaven with an axe on your back, a sword at your waist, and 50 knives.
His jaw tightened, and she could see he was preparing a list of protests.
No,
she said, raising a hand to cut him off.
One knife. You may keep one knife, and that's it. The rest of it stays here. We will come back for it once we have a car. I can explain your costume by telling people you are working on one of those battle reenactment thingies, but I will not be able to explain so many weapons.
With a gusty sigh, he removed his weapons. After depositing them beneath a tree, he moved reluctantly toward the village.
Excuse me, she said to his back.
What now?
He stopped and glanced back at her, clearly exasperated. She gazed pointedly at the sword, which he hadn't removed.
You said one knife. You didn't specify what size it should be.
There was a dangerous glint in his gaze, and realizing she'd pushed him as far as he would bend, she acquiesced. She'd just say the sword was part of the costume. She glanced at it, wishing those glittering gems in the hilt looked less real. They could end up getting mugged for some silly fake sword. At the rental agency, Gwyn leased the last, dilapidated little car and arranged to collect it in an hour, which would give them ample time to purchase clothing, food, and coffee before leaving for Alborath, guiding him past the curious stares of the onlookers, and occasionally tugging on his arm when he stopped to stare. She finally got him into Barrett's, a sporting goods store that had the obligatory tourist's miscellany of other items. In no time he would be presentable. People would stop gawking at him as he passed before turning their scrutiny to her, as if trying to figure out what a perfectly normal-looking, albeit a bit grubby, American was doing strolling about with such a barbarian. They would stop drawing attention to themselves, a thing Gwyn despised, and they would take a nice drive to Alborath. Perhaps have lunch with his family while she explained how she'd found him. She'd entrust him to his familial bosom and then catch up with her tour group in the next village.
Do you really want to leave him? Return to the seniors? She thought.
After last night, she was no longer certain she would be able to leave him. Perhaps she'd linger for a time near his home and see how he fared before moving on. It wasn't as if there was anything in the States she was in a hurry to get back to. Not her job. Not the exquisite, sprawling house on Canyon Road in Santa Fe she'd avoided since her parents' death. Too many memories. Still fresh and painful. Perhaps she would check into a bed and breakfast near Druston's home for a while. It would be the compassionate thing to do.
Where are you going? she hissed when he swept past her, trailing his hand over a rack of purple running suits. He brushed his hand over a lavender sweatshirt, then stared at a lilac sweatband, ignoring her. She shook her head, but, after a moment's vacillation, decided he should be harmless enough wandering the store while she selected something for him to wear. She turned her attention to choosing clothing for a man who had the overly developed body of a professional athlete. Although Barrett's carried a variety of clothing, few men had his height and muscle. She tucked some jeans beneath an arm, eyed a denim button-down, and glanced at his wide shoulders. It had never fit. A V-neck T-shirt might do, in stretchy cotton, but definitely not white. It would contrast entirely too nicely with his silky dark hair and deep golden skin. The sight of a white tee stretched across his muscular chest might persuade her to catapult her cherry at him. She felt him return to her. The hair on the back of her neck tingled the moment he stepped beside her, but she refused to glance at him. At the same moment, a feminine purr from the other side of her asked,
"May I help you?"
Gwyn glanced up from the pile of T-shirts to find a tall, leggy, 30-ish sales lady, librarian glasses perched on her nose above a lushly pursed mouth, looking past her, eyeing the McKelter with fascination.
"Where in the old dress are you now?"
She spoke with a lilting burr, ignoring Gwyn entirely.
"Such a lovely weave. I've no seen the pattern before."
Drustin folded his arms across his chest, his body rippling beneath the leather bands.
"And you won't," he said. "'Tis the Keltars alone."
There went the lion-like toss of his head, which on a woman would have looked coy, but on him was an irresistible, "Come hither if you think you can handle me." Gwyn didn't wait for the saleslady to start drooling, or go hither. She thrust a pile of jeans and shirts into Drustin's arms, forcing him to unfold his arms and drop the He-Man pose.
"Allow me to show you to a fitting room," the saleslady purred. "I'm quite confident we'll find something to satisfy your desires at Barrett's."
Oh, choke me on innuendo, Gwyn thought, not caring one bit for the interest in the woman's eyes. He might be crazy, but he was her deluded hunk. She'd found him. Blocking the aisle to prevent, she glanced at the woman's name tag, Miriam, from latching onto him, she nudged Drustin toward the dressing room. Miriam sniffed and tried to step around her, but Gwyn engaged her in a determined, irritated little dance in the narrow aisle until she heard Drustin close the dressing room door behind her. Plunking her fists on her waist, Gwyn looked down her nose, up at leggy Miriam, and said,
"We lost our luggage. His costume was all he had in his carry-on. We don't need any help."
Miriam glanced at the fitting room, where Drustin's muscular calves were visible beneath the short, white, slatted door, then contemptuously examined Gwyn, from her not very recently shaped eyebrows to the muddy toes of her hiking boots.
"Found yourself a Scotsman, did you now, wee Niaf? You Americans are given to sampling our men with the same thirst you turn to our whiskey, and you can't handle our whiskey either." "I can most certainly handle my husband from here," Gwyn snapped, louder than she would have liked.
Miriam directed a pointed look at her ringless hand and arched a meticulously shaped brow that made Gwyn feel she had small, unruly bushes growing above her eyes, but she refused to be humbled and returned the stare in icy silence. When Gwyn made no effort to explain why she sported no wedding band and displayed no inclination to quit blocking the aisle, Miriam moved off in a snit to fluff and tidy the sweaters Gwyn had messed up on the display table. Swallowing a cat-like growl, Gwyn moved to stand guard outside the fitting room, tapping her foot impatiently. A swoosh of fabric alerted her that he'd removed his plaid, and Gwyn tried hard not to think about him standing behind the flimsy door, nude. It was harder than trying not to think about a cigarette, and her disobedient thoughts handled it as badly. The more she tried not to think it, the more she thought it.
"Gwyn?"
Dragging herself from a fantasy in which she was about to drip chocolate syrup on him, she said,
"Hmm?"
"These trews. Ach, by Amerchen!"
Gwyn snorted. The McKelter was pretending to discover zippers, and if he was wearing the plaid true to the 16th century, According to what their tour guide had told them, he had no underwear on. She heard a few more muttered curses, then a zip, yet another curse. He sounded so convincing.
"Come out and let me see you,"
she said, struggling to keep a straight face. His voice sounded strangled when he replied,
"You'll have to come in."
Sneaking a furtive glance at Miriam, who had conveniently been accosted by a pimple-faced teenage boy, Gwyn entered the dressing room. He was regarding himself in the mirror, and his back was to her. And heavens, but she would have been much better off if she'd never seen his tight, muscled ass in a pair of tight, faded jeans. His long, black hair rippled over his shoulders and down his back, inviting her to plunge her fingers in it and trail them down the splendid ridges of muscle.
"Turn around,"
she said, her mouth suddenly dry. He did so, with a scowl. She eyed his bare chest, and with effort, forced herself to remember she was supposed to be looking at the jeans. Her gaze skimmed downward over his rippled abdomen and lean hips and—
"What have you stuffed in your pants, McKelter?"
she demanded.
"Nothing that wasn't God-given," he replied stiffly.
Gwyn stared.
"There's no way that's part of you. You must have gotten a sock or something stuck. Oh, my."
She pried her gaze away from his groin. A muscle worked in his jaw, and he was clearly in discomfort.
"I do not believe you intended to torture me. Nay, I saw other men on the street in such clothing, so I will not take punitive measures. However, I think the problem is much the same as my feet," he informed her.
"Your feet?"
she repeated dumbly, her gaze dropping. They were large.
"Aye."
He gestured toward hers.
"In your time, you bind your feet in constrictive boots, whereas we wear soft, supple leather."
Your point?" she managed.
"They have more room to grow,"
he said, as if she were simple-minded. Gwyn blushed, of all things to play a joke on her about, stuffing socks in his pants indeed.
"McKelter, I do not believe for one minute that that,"
she gestured at the bulge in his jeans,
"is you. I may be gullible, but I do know what men look like, and that is not what men look like."
He flattened her up against the door of the dressing room, and his sensual mouth, much too close for safety, curved in a cocksure smile.
"Then you will simply have to see for yourself. Touch me, lass. Feel my sock."
His silver gaze sizzled with challenge as he unzipped his zipper.
"Uh-uh."
She shook her head for added emphasis.
"Then find me a pair of trews that do not threaten to sever my man parts."
"Uh-huh,"
she agreed, trying not to think about that unzipped zipper.
"Do not let this frighten you, lass. We will fit together weel when I make love to you," he purred.
Weel was how it came out, and his lovely brogue, coupled with his sock, were nearly all the persuasion she needed to set to removing his jeans with her teeth. She closed her eyes.
"Back up, bud, or I'll help you fit in those trews," she threatened, "with your sword if necessary."
"Look at me, Gwendolyn,"
he said softly.
"Gwen,"
she snapped.
"Gwen,"
he acquiesced, right before he kissed her. Chapter 7. Heat lightning, Gwyn thought. His touch is electrifying. Attraction sizzled between them, and she knew he felt it too, because he drew back and looked at her strangely. Then, nudging her lips apart with his thumb, he opened her mouth and brushed his firm lips back and forth over hers, creating a light and irresistible friction.
"Yes," she thought. "This is what I've needed. I feel... ah."
He tilted her head at the perfect angle, just like Lancelot did Guinevere in that single kiss between them in the movie First Night, and sealed his mouth over hers. She shivered when his tongue plunged between her lips, hot and silky and raw man. "Take that, Miriam!"
she thought. Dizzied by a rush of desire, her head plopped limply back against the dressing room door. She slid her hands up the rippling muscles of his arms, over his shoulders, then locked them firmly behind his neck. She hadn't gone to Scotland, fallen in a hole and met a madman. She'd died and gone to heaven, and he was her reward for putting up with her parents for so many years. He closed his hands on her waist, then slid them intimately upward as he deepened the kiss, lingering over each curve. When he flattened his palms roughly over her breasts, her thighs popped open so smoothly that she wondered why she didn't just have a placard taped across them that said, "Squeeze here for sex." She arched her back, rubbing her hard nipples against his calloused palms. The sock she'd accused him of having was the hardest sock she'd ever felt, and dangerously close to being smack dab between her thighs. And she wanted him there, by God. She wanted to feel him silky and hot inside her, naked, with nothing between them. He brushed her nipples with his thumbs as his tongue glided deeper, slick and hungry, so deep it coaxed soft little mewling noises from her throat. With a subtle turn of their bodies, he shifted his erection into the V of her thighs and thrust his hips with the same ruthless, insistent rhythm as he thrust his tongue into her mouth. When he cupped her bottom and lifted her against him, she vaulted happily onto him, wrapped her legs around his waist, and kissed him frantically. She arched against him, trying to get as close as possible, with so much irritating, restrictive clothing between them. She threaded her fingers into his silky hair. She suckled his tongue, desperate for more of him. He made a kind of laughing, satisfied male sound deep in his throat, clamped her head between his hands, and kissed her so hard he drew her breath into his body. His tongue glided into her mouth, withdrew and returned. She felt her skin rippling with kinetic energy where he touched her. She was soaking it up and growing hotter at the core. This man knew her natural frequency and was making her resonate to perfect pitch. And as fine crystal, if vibrated continuously at its natural frequency, would shatter, she hovered mere caresses away from a similar explosion.
"Might I find you a different size or style?"
chirped Miriam beyond the dressing room door, inspiring the only benevolent feeling Gwen would ever entertain about her, for rescuing her before she shucked her virginity on a fitting room floor to a madman, with a door that ended a foot above the floor. Drustin groaned, then deepened the kiss.
"How embarrassing!"
Gwyn's sanity returned in degrees.
"The man kisses me and I just hop right on him like he's the hottest new ride at Disneyland. Have I lost my mind?"
She dug her fingernails into his shoulders and bit his tongue.
"Ouch! I dunno think that was necessary,"
he whispered, passion blazing in his eyes, coupled with irritation that someone had dared interrupt them. He was clearly not a man who liked to stop anything he'd begun. He looked downright dangerously aroused.
"Ma'am?"
Miriam said in a pinched tone. Gwen was mortified to realize she was making soft panting noises. She took a deep breath, forced herself to unwrap her legs, and slid down his body. His hands tightened on her hips until she threatened his shoulders with her nails again. Reluctantly, he lowered her to the floor, then promptly tried to kiss her again.
"Stop it!"
she whispered furiously. After drawing another shaky breath, she called out to Miriam.
"Yeah, clothes. Right, how about, a pair of those khakis? The Loose Fit brand and a 32... Oh, wait a minute."
She shook her head, trying to clear it. To accommodate his muscular thighs, they would have to be loose on his waist.
"Bring a 34, 36, and 38-inch waist," she corrected. "And a belt."
She closed her eyes and drew several more deep breaths. Her heart was thundering like a battering ram against the wall of her chest.
"Ma'am?"
Miriam cooed so sweetly that only another woman would have heard the bitchiness.
"Yes. I realize Americans are different. And perhaps your feet were no longer on the floor because you were perched on the chair, admiring the state-of-the-art video cams we recently installed. But there are children in the store, and in Scotland we take the upbringing of them seriously. These dressing rooms are not co-ed."
Her face flamed.
Get off me, you oaf!
She hissed, pushing at his chest. He gave her a look that promised they would continue where they'd left off, and soon, before stepping back.
As you wish, wife.
He purred, then opened the door with a flourish and a courtly bow. Gwyn blushed, so much for hoping he hadn't heard her snap at Miriam earlier. She stepped out, and there stood the infernal Miriam, staring past her at Drustin McKelter clad in tight, unzipped jeans and no shirt.
Oh my!
Miriam wet her lips.
I'll just get those khakis.
But Miriam didn't move an inch, and Gwyn wanted to kick her, better yet, smack her eyeballs back into her head.
You were going to get those pants,
Gwyn reminded stiffly.
Oh, yes,
Miriam said, flustered.
If the khakis don't cover, fit, perhaps he could try running pants. They're quite roomy.
She flashed a brilliant smile at Drustin, her gaze darting from the barely covered bulge at his groin to his ringless hand.
Fine, bring some of those too.
Gwyn glared at Drustin, then pulled the door tightly shut. She leaned back against it and sighed, trying to collect herself.
I want purple trews, lass,
Drustin called over the door.
No,
she said irritably.
And a purple shirt.
Absolutely not, she thought. His black hair and dark skin would look incredible offset by such a vibrant color. Maybe black would make him look drab. One could always hope. When, after a few moments and unintelligible curses later, she heard his jeans hit the floor, she imagined him nude and wondered if someone might have slipped her an aphrodisiac in the past 24 hours.
Find a man you want to talk with into the wee hours. A man you can argue with when necessary, and a man who makes you sizzle when he touches you,
Beatrice had said.
Well, the sizzle was there, and they certainly could argue.
She shook her head, refusing to entertain the notion that a madman might be her potential soulmate. Might he have a point about his feet? Did things truly grow larger if unconfined? It certainly hadn't felt like a sock. More like that can of tennis balls on the shelf behind the cash register. She glanced down at her breasts. Should she stop wearing a bra and start wearing snugger panties? How was she going to look at him now? The running pants were tolerable, Drustin decided, relieved. The blue trews had clearly been a torture device and would have strangled a man's seed. Mayhap, men were fashioned differently in her time. He hadn't seen one other bulge out there on the street. Mayhap they all had wee carrots in their trews. Mayhap there were hundreds of unsatisfied women in this century. Although at the moment, only one woman's satisfaction was of paramount interest to him, and he was rapidly becoming obsessed with her. Gwen Cassidy did something unnatural to him, made him feel weak-kneed and powerful at the same time, made him feel the potency and virility of his druid blood hammering in his veins. When he touched her, everything in the world made perfect sense, as if constructed of elegant mathematical equations. He should fear her because, when holding her, he forgot everything he should be worrying about. Druids maintained that the larger an object, the more impact that object had upon the space in which it existed, and the greater the pull it exerted on other objects. Drustin had always considered himself walking proof of such a postulation. But Gwyn, tiny Gwyn, had very little mass, yet a monumental impact on his world. She defied the laws of nature. Sighing, he forced his thoughts away from her firm little body and studied himself in the mirror. The black trews, named Adidas, were fitted yet baggy, with remarkable stretchy stuff at the waist and ankles. They were by far the most suitable selection. He admired the black fabric, densely woven. He suspected it might repel water. Purple would have been better, but black was acceptable. Not royal, still not surf colors. The blue trews had been painful and a terrible dye job to boot, as if the color hadn't set in. No weaver in his clan would have owned up to such terrible craft. And those bland, khaki trews, although a reasonable fit,
would have branded him a crofter, which the Keltar wasn't. His own plaid of royal purple and black, shot with costly silver threads, he rolled neatly around three of his leather bands and stuffed under his arm. Her people clearly did not adhere to Brehon law. There'd been racks of purple attire, for simply anyone to purchase, arrayed throughout the store. The Keltar, centuries past and with much pomp and ceremony, had been gifted the full use of the seven colors by a Gael king. The MacKeltar lairds were entitled to wear purple so long as a Keltar lived. And by God he did. Live, that is. Mayhap none other of his clan did, but he was alive, and once he got to his stones he would find out what had gone wrong. He was apprehensive about this world of hers, this wagon of hers. But to arrive at Castle Keltar today he would have ridden a fire-breathing dragon. He prayed that by some miracle Sylvan might have lived and fathered children. Even at his advanced age it wasn't impossible, and that he would find descendants alive and well. He prayed that if not, he would at least find his castle unscathed by time, that he would secure the tablets and by midnight tomorrow eve be standing safely in his own century again. No abrasive noises, no awful odors, no unnatural rhythm of Gaea herself. Kicking aside the hard white shoes with strings that she'd thrust under the door moments ago, he put his boots back on. He balled his fists inside the T-shirt, having absolutely no idea why it was called a T-shirt, as opposed to an A-shirt or B-shirt, and stretched the fabric so it wasn't quite so restrictive around his neck and chest. Opening the door, he paused a moment and swept his gaze over her petite, shapely body. They would fit well, although he suspected she wouldn't believe that until he demonstrated, and he hoped to demonstrate many times. He liked Gwen Cassidy, prickly, stubborn, a touch domineering and bossy, in addition to aching to rip her clothes off and push her down on her back in sweet heather. Spread her legs and tease until she begged for him. Bury his face between her breasts and taste her skin. Their kiss had only whetted his appetite for her, and he groaned, recalling how difficult it had been to peel those blue trews down over his swollen shaft. He stood in the doorway, looped his sporran about his hips, fastened one of his leather bands atop it, and thrust his sword through it. He moved silently behind her and closed his hands on the slender span of her waist. Grinning, he slipped his hands lower. She had a luscious ass, soft and womanly and shaped like a plump upside-down heart, and he'd take advantage of every opportunity to touch it. He was about to press a finger intimately between her twin globes when she tensed and shot out of his grasp. He arched a brow at the sales lady.
"My wife is still growing accustomed to me. We haven't been wed long."
He quite liked the way "wife" had sounded on his tongue, he thought, eyeing Gwen.
"Nice sword,"
the sales lady purred, looking nearly a foot to the left of it. Gwen pivoted on her heel.
"Come on," she said to Drustin. "Husband."
The look he gave her sizzled with passion, and she was beginning to wonder just how long she was going to be able to keep him under control, if she'd ever really had him under control to begin with.
"I'd like to grow accustomed to you,"
Miriam murmured as she watched the magnificent man guide his wife out the door with a possessive palm to the small of her back. He tossed her a flirtatious grin over his shoulder. Gwyn's spirits lifted a few blocks from the cafe, buoyed by the tantalizing aroma of fresh-ground coffee beans wafting on a gentle breeze. In a matter of moments, she would be ordering cappuccino and chocolate bread, cranberry and orange scones. Gwen released a heartfelt sigh of pleasure as they entered the cafe.
"Lass, there are so many people," Drustin said uneasily. "Does the entirety of this village belong to one laird?"
Gwen glanced at him and decided she should have gone with the white T-shirt, because Drustin MacKeltar, clad from head to toe in unbroken black, was, as her girlfriend Beth would say, just downright fuckable. She was still experiencing shivers of resonance from their kiss that were never going to stop unless she quit looking at him, so she glanced hastily around the shop.
Families with children, seniors and young couples, mostly tourists, were seated at dozens of small tables.
No, they're probably all from different families.
And they're peaceable. All these different clans eat together and are happy about it, he exclaimed at sufficient volume that several people turned to look at them.
Shh! You're drawing attention to us.
I always draw attention, even more so in this time. We little folks, the lot of you.
She glared at him.
Just be quiet, behave, and let me order.
I am being Have,
he muttered, then moved away to gawk at the shiny silver machines grinding and perking and steaming. Being Have, with a long A? His command of language baffled her. But then she thought about it a moment. Be good, being good. Be quiet, being quiet. Behave, being Have. There was an unsettling consistency to his madness. What was it Newton had said? I can calculate the motion of heavenly bodies, but not the madness of people. While Gwen ordered, Drustin circled the interior of the coffee shop, missing nothing. He seemed fascinated by everything, picking up stainless steel mugs.